We're super excited. She's going to talk to us about eliminating entitlement, which I know is something that I am eager to hear about with my children. So she's a writer, speaker, child advocate with humor and heart. She speaks around the world how to have authentic relationships and cultivate empathy. Her work has been featured in Huffington Post, Darling Magazine, and The Good Men Project, Yahoo Parenting, and on her own site. She does serve on the Compassion International Artists and Speakers team, and she is committed to helping children living in extreme poverty around the world. Her claim to fame is her double name, Christy Christie. She says she married just the right man, David Christie, and they do live in Calabasas. She is fresh off a trip to India, so she is going to have some really exciting things to share with us. So please help me welcome Christy.
Thank you so much. What fun to be with all of you. I kind of have a crush on your church. I'm telling the truth. I was at Malibu Press for a long time, but before that, I grew up at Burbank Presbyterian, and there's this sweet woman who was my children's and family director growing up, my little children's pastor. She'd help me with gluing everything together and all that, and that was Jenny Parrish, if any of you know her, who was kind of a matriarch here at this church. And so I've always known about your church and just always loved coming down and visiting her and hearing about kids' games and all of it. So fun to be with you in that way. So this is a fun topic. And I've had a few of you already come up to me and go, I'm so excited to hear about this because I'm concerned about it. And I think that's, you're not alone, you know? I think we have kind of a collective fear in our generation of like, we don't really want to make the same mistakes that maybe happened to the generation before, right? And we also see that there are really, there's a great need for people to grow empathy and be connected to the needs and feelings of others. So here's how this started for me. I was on a date night with my husband. We were at one of those places in the community that you might have in your community. It goes something like Barnes & Noble, Yogurtland, Panera, movie theater. Have you been there? Okay. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You don't even know where I was. And we were out on a date night, and we were having fun, and we were like, we had a few minutes before the movie, and we walked over to Barnes & Noble. And in that process, because I've been a children's pastor for the last 20 years in the different communities and 10 in that community, there was a group of 14-year-olds that went running by us, and I knew some of them. And so I had to be once again reminded at that moment, I'm not in charge, you know? I'm not actually commissioned to discipline children in public, you know? And so I see them run by, and they nearly knocked David over, and I went to kind of say, hey, you know, and David goes, just let it be. But their collective noise was this, move, mine, get out of my way, me first. And I thought, man. And 2 weeks later, I found myself on the dirt roads of the Dominican Republic, amongst some of the poorest of the poor, up along the Haiti border in this mountain community where the people that live there live on less than 50 cents a day. Now, the international extreme poverty line, according to UNICEF, sits at $1.90 a day. So you have to know, these are some of the poorest people on our planet. And as we got to their village, which was being supported by Compassion International, I got to see with my eyes the difference that made. Right? And here are some of the kids, vibrant, alive, happy, fulfilled, because, friends, they had enough, you know? Because the opposite of poverty isn't wealth, it's enough. And so my friend who was there was he's a magician, and he also speaks for Compassion, but he was totally winning the kid popularity contest because he had magic tricks, you know? Come on. There was no marker activity or puppet show I could give that would compete with him. And so he's sitting there, and he grabs a snack pack of Oreos from our bus, and he's doing magic tricks with them, and he's sort of eating them. And I'm thinking, okay, what goes through my brain, and if you have children, you understand, I'm thinking, I hope he knows, as a single guy, not to hand one Oreo to one kid. right? We don't have 60 Oreos. There are a lot of children here, and we will have a riot on our hands, right? And I braced myself waiting for that to happen because I watched as little Victor, standing right in front of him in Spanish, said, "May I have one?" And I learned right then and there that there is no language barrier when it comes to double stuffed Oreos. So good news, right? The gospel of Oreos. No. And he hands the Oreo to him. And I brace myself and I watch as Victor takes a bite from the Oreo, turns to his friend, and his friend takes a bite, and his friend takes the Oreo and passes it along. And I stood there with tears in my eyes with a few of my friends as I watched five children share one Oreo. Without being told, without being encouraged, they just knew that community and connection with others and their needs and sharing was survival and connection and was the way we're supposed to live. And I thought, in that moment, God, what are you showing me? What do I need to see here? Because I've worked with kids in Malibu and in Burbank and all over Southern California, and they're awesome. But I know for a fact, and even myself as a child, I know there wouldn't have been a lot of sharing going on with one Oreo. It kind of would have gone like, na, 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 na. You know, it's mine, you know. Sorry, you know, you're left out. But I started doing what you do when you're curious, right? And I started Google searching the word entitlement America, entitlement children, entitlement solutions, because I didn't want to just dive way into the problem. I wanted to dive into some practical, measurable solutions. How do we solve this problem that we have? How do we teach kids how to care about others? Do we have to put them on a plane and take them to the Dominican Republic to introduce them to Victor so Victor can teach them how to share Oreos? Like, do we have to do that? Or can we just put some things in place here and now that would transform their story and the way that they live? So what I found, though, was startling as I did my Google searching. And I learned that college students today are 40% less empathetic than students just 20 years ago. Wow, that's a dramatic change. And I thought, is this just one junky study, right? You know, can I throw this one away? And what I found out was that many of our major universities, in fact, Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard, University of Michigan, MIT, they're all doing research on this decline of empathy. And in fact, I ran into a man who works in Silicon Valley, and he said, "Empathy, talk to me about it, because our entire team of young people have no empathy. We have a problem." And I thought, wow, okay. So how do you measure empathy, right? That's my next question is, okay, but how do you measure it? It's really, can you put yourself in someone else's shoes? Can you imagine what it's like to feel their experience and feelings? Are you able to sustain and connect and make eye contact? To build intimate friendships and connections where you share your deep feelings and thoughts because you know someone else can step into your shoes and empathize and connect with you? See, empathy is essential. And I found that really it lives sometimes mutually, that you can be entitled and empathetic, but a lot of times, the more empathetic you are, the more connected you are to the needs of others, the less entitled you are and the less you think you need to just go grab for yours. And so I want to start it off with a fun little video that illustrates what empathy is. So here you go. Fun, right? I love this video. It makes me laugh every time. And what I love it, does anybody want Mark to explain a few more words? Anybody? Yeah, come on. All right, we can say that. Oops, okay. Yeah, I love it because it's fun, but also it really illustrates how we have to model empathy for our children to get it. That when he just simply told Murray about empathy and what it was, he didn't get it. He didn't get it. He didn't get it. But as he continued to model it on a developmental level that he could see and understand and feel it, he got it. And in many ways, our kids, we've done so much work as a culture on anti-bullying, haven't we? the last 10 years have very much been focused on that in the schools and trying to bring up the kindness level, bring down the bullying level. And yet, this data. And what I've found as I'm continuing to read and research and learn is that, you know, if the change and transformation that you want to see happen doesn't happen from the inside out, it's simply a morality code being imposed on you from the outside in. It's sort of like a diet on the first of the year, right? No one wants to do that, right? But it's when we start to believe that we want to make healthy choices from the inside out that transformation happens, right? It's many things. We all change from the inside out, and our kids do too. They need to have experiences and connections with others that help inspire them to grow empathy. And so why is empathy so important? Sure, it brings down that bratty entitlement level. I've still been yet to find a family that's wanting to raise an entitled child, a spoiled brat. They're like, that's our goal. We're working on it. Good. Yeah. Taking them to the mall, doing our best, you know? I'm yet to meet them. I've seen a lot of families do it. But really, most people are well-intentioned, trying to raise kids that have gratitude and connection to others. So what are some best practices? Is that what you're wondering? Because that's what I was wondering. How do we really do this in a way that's measurable and proven and not just kind of some feel-good activities that make us feel better and hope for the best? And so I put together 5 different messages that I believe if we plant them at the soul of our kids as we lead and parent and care for them, we'll see that kind of transformation take place. And I've seen this happen over and over again over the years, that these things really work. And they're easy and simple and things that you might already be doing. So let me affirm some of that, but also just give you some ideas that you can tuck away and do even today. So the first is going to sound harsh, especially as we're thinking of preschoolers, okay? But it is, life is hard. Right? Can you imagine saying that to your 2-year-old? Look, life is hard. Good luck, you know? That's not what I'm really talking about. What I'm talking about is really empowering kids to know that life isn't always just a cakewalk. It's also in not removing challenging circumstances and things from their life, because growth happens when we face hard challenges, doesn't it? Have you ever grown when you're really comfortable and happy and healthy and everything's easy? Usually not. I wish. But usually you face something uncertain or hard and you have to step forward into that challenge, step across the void, step into uncomfortable things to broaden your comfort zone and grow. And so when we value safety so much and comfort, and that's our ultimate goal. And honestly, I'll tell you, that's been the goal of a generation of parents before us, that comfort and safety, and let me give you every opportunity so you can thrive. But often we miss it, that we insulate them from the growth experiences that are God's gift to us, even though we don't always like it, right? And so it starts really young, if we allow it, where it's, how do we tell our kids, you got this, you can do it? But also, how do we help make sure that they are protected and kept safe? You know, it's a balance, isn't it? We live in a media culture where there is so much coming our way all the time. We can be very aware of just how hard life is for everyone else. It can be too much. And that's some of the research showing that there's just this kind of overwhelm that causes people to remove and step back and kind of deaden themselves to the feelings and experiences of others. And honestly, that can be a trauma response too. A trauma response being that when you experience too many things that are just so painful for you or for even others, you start to kind of back away from the building, you know? And take good care of you if you can. But we know that often when we distance and detach, that's the worst place, right? Because we're made to be connected to each other. We're created to be in relationship. And you hear stories of kids in orphanages who haven't been touched and they have deformities and they're not thriving. And the minute they're held and hugged, they come alive. And so it's in knowing and teaching our kids that life is hard, but that we also need to make sure that we protect them from too much of TMI, too much information, you know? It's the way we live. We live plugged into the wall at all times, isn't it? It's like too much. And so we have to build Sabbath into our lives so that when hard things come, we can feel them, experience them, and move through them. I want to mention just that a lot of the research is showing that there's a very direct correlation between too much screen time and a decline of empathy. If you think about it in this research, they showing the one I just showed you from University of Michigan, but there's also a body of work I read called Making Caring Common out of Harvard. And they basically are saying too that, you know, when you have too much screen, that in the last, there's been a huge decline. Too many thoughts at once. Give me a minute. See, I'm plugged in. Yeah, okay. There's been the steepest decline in the last 10 years in empathy. So I thought, well, what's changed in the last 10 years? The iPhone came out in 2007. So our screen, our relationship with screens has really changed. And in fact, we sometimes think that having interactive screen time is just better than passive screen time. So passive screen time is what we all grew up with, right? My family sitting around in the den watching Seventh Heaven on Monday nights. Come on, you know? That was screen time, you know? We even limited that, right? I want to read you a quote that I found yesterday, actually. It says, "Children's brains are much more sensitive to electronic use than most of us realize. In fact, contrary to popular belief, it doesn't take much electronic stimulation to throw a sensitive and still developing brain off track. Also, many parents mistakenly believe that interactive screen time, internet and social media use, texting, emailing, and gaming isn't harmful, especially compared to passive screen time like watching TV. In fact, interactive screen time is more likely to cause sleep, mood, and cognitive issues because it's more likely to cause hyperarousal and compulsive use." So this is really talking about dopamine and some of the brain chemicals that get aroused when we're on social media or interacting online, and it can, for a developing brain, really take things off kilter just a little bit. And we know that when things are just a little off kilter, it changes our behavior and mood and experience of life greatly, doesn't it? Just deprive me of sleep for 12 hours and I'll show you. And so it's really in monitoring that, because also when they experience too much of the pain in life, it causes them to be numb. Now, the other side of this is I have a friend who just sent her daughter off to NYU, 17 years old, big bad streets of New York. Scary, right? I can't even imagine. And, you know, she said to me, she said, "I hope we prepared her enough." And by that, what she realized was after a semester, she came home a mess, just like, I won't go into all the details, but it meant some real work to get her back to a stable place. As we were talking it through and having those honest girlfriend talks that you have, you know, she said, "I think we protected her from the hard stuff in life too much. I think she didn't know how to thrive because she hadn't gone through hard things on a regular basis. She'd had it all kind of handed to her. Her first phone call home from college was, 'Mom, my bank account's empty because cabs and restaurants in the Village in New York are too expensive.'" She's like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 what? What about the cafeteria?" "Oh, the cafeteria is gross, Mom. I have to go out." It's like, oh, okay, you know? And that wasn't what she had in mind and envisioned as she was carefully raising this little girl and raising her in the church. But in fact, she'd been isolated from the pain that she needed to feel so that she could grow those emotional muscles to thrive. We know that babies need to, and children as they grow, need to be exposed to germs eventually, or else they don't develop those emotions, the immunities to thrive, to ward off tough things. But similarly, our emotional muscles have to be developed so that we can thrive too. All right, the next one, next message is you will come through this. So those are really connected, right? It's life is hard, but you are going to come through this. And that confidence that we can hand our kids to say, you're going to come through, you got this, is the gift we give to kids to know that they can go and face the hard things that are in front of them. So this is a body of work called emotion coaching or emotion regulation. It's something really to be thinking about. I think it's one of the greatest gifts we can give kids. And when you know how to sit with emotional, with your uncomfortable feelings and emotions, it's such a great gift because you don't have to turn towards the distractions that often don't lead to life, right? I met with a woman once I was speaking up in Northern California. She came up with me afterwards and she said, I'm so glad you're talking about this. And I said, good, good, you know. And she said, I work in a drug and alcohol rehab clinic. And this is exactly what we're teaching our patients, how to move through your feelings. Let me give you an example. So I was part of MOPS with Malibu Presbyterian Church for 7 years. And if you know any of our story there at that church, about 8 months after I'd taken the job as the children's pastor, the church burned to the ground on a Sunday morning, completely gone. So we had a MOPS group of about 90 moms who were high achievers and not going to let that fire keep them down, you know. And so we found a camp to meet in with bodies of water everywhere without fences around them. It was a total nightmare, okay? And I'm thinking as I'm watching this, okay, the separation anxiety is going to be horrible. We're going to, MOPS is not going to go well. I'm thinking through, how do I need to be helping, right? We get through all of it, the first meeting, and there's one little boy left just sobbing, you know, and they're like, where's his mom? And I've got all these college students that are like, I don't even know what to do right now, you know. So I scooped him up and I tried and I'm like, let me try. So I said, hey, Isaiah, stop crying. You're good. Your mom's going to come back. It's good. Isaiah, we really need you to stop crying. You know, I'm getting frustrated too. I'm like, come on. I knew his mom needed the timeout. I was hoping that he'd calm down. And that little boy taught me something so big. He took his two little hands, he pushed back on my shoulders, and with his tear-stained blue eyes, he looked me in the eyes and he said, Miss Christie, is it okay for me to be sad with you? And I thought, well, yes, it is. And so my effort to get him to stop being sad because it's inconvenient for us right now wasn't helping him move through that moment. And so I changed my language, and I've changed it from now on. I said, Isaiah, I'm here for you. Let it out. I've got you. I'm not going to let you go. Your mom's going to come back, and she loves you, but I've got you right now, and it's okay to cry. Go ahead. Let it out. And you know, the minute we give each other and our kids and our people permission to feel, and we create and hold that space for them, something beautiful and miraculous happens because we all need that space. It works in marriage too. Good news, right? It's saying to someone, you have space to feel your feelings. And I heard from a psychologist that I listened to at Pepperdine University. I've got her name. Dr. Rosenberg, let's say that. It's on my other paper. But she basically said that our uncomfortable feelings that we avoid so much with social media use, with shopping, with alcohol, with whatever your poison is, right? Those uncomfortable feelings that we avoid usually only last in our bodies. We're trying to avoid this like somatic body experience of feeling uncomfortable with something. It usually only lasts about 90 seconds. So if we actually sit with our feelings and go, I'm really feeling sad and identify it, it moves through us rather quickly. And she had this great phrase that I think I want to hand to you as a tool. And it's ride the wave. And so she says she uses this with kids a lot to say, hey, you're feeling sad? It's okay. Just ride the wave. Stick with it. Feel it. Let it out. I'm here for you. And she says, it's amazing that in about 90 seconds, that intensity, it may not go away forever, right? We ride a lot of waves sometimes, and that's what grief is, up and down, right? But ride the wave, feel it. And it gives kids a language to see that waves come in and waves go out, waves come in and waves go out, and our emotions are that way. So giving them those tools will help them deal with their own feelings so they can connect to others, grow their empathy. All right. So let's see, I want to go back here. Here's a quote for you about this. It says, emotion regulation means being able to think constructively about how to cope with feelings. We want children to have their feelings, but not be overwhelmed by them. To feel discouraged, but not give up. To feel anxious, but not stay home. And to be excited, but not get so carried away in their enthusiasm that they use poor judgment making decisions. So it's really in that striking that balance and finding space for that. I've put together, I know I've mentioned a few different studies, and I just have been asked a few times, hey, where do I find that? What do I get? So I put together a PDF for you. If you would like it, it'll just download into your inbox, and that'd be the end of it. And it's just a PDF that has some good resources on emotion coaching, some podcasts that kind of explain some of these things and talk about screen time, and just some good resources I found that I wanted to share with you. So here's an easy thing. We'll just do, oops, there we go, wait. If you want to right now, I'm going to give you about 15 seconds just to do to the number 44222, text the word grow empathy. It can be all caps or a lowercase, either one. Just make sure there's no space in between grow and empathy. And so I'll give you a couple of seconds to do that, and then we'll move on. Okay. You can keep doing that. People matter most. I met a man, he called my office actually when I was a children's pastor and said it was about, I would say it was about December 21st. And our church was good at doing all the shoe boxes and Christmas baskets. Have you done some of that stuff here? Probably, yeah. So but by the 21st, we were pretty done with all of that. And we're heading into Jesus's birthday, you know, we're a little busy, you know. So he calls on the phone and says, hey, your friend Mike gave me your number and I need your help. And I'm like, okay. He was very forceful on the phone. And I thought, all right, what's going on here, you know? And he said, I have a 13-year-old, and I just saw our Christmas list, and it's an expensive Christmas list, and so I need to teach her a lesson. And I'm like, oh, all right, and that's my job. So he was giving that job to me, to teach her a lesson. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, he said, what do you have in mind, sir? And he said, well, do you have a family who doesn't have anything that she can go shopping for? I've heard that churches do that thing. And I said, yeah, we totally do. We're kind of done with that though, unfortunately. So might have another approach here, you know, but I said, let me take your information. Let me see what I can do. And I'll give you a call back if I hear anything. I didn't expect to have a solution for him, right? In that way, in the way he wanted. 2 hours later, the phone rings in my office, and a woman from the Single Mothers Outreach Group in that area calls and says, Christy, I have a family that I just was connected with, and I was wondering, I know this is so last minute, but do you know anybody that could help them? I'm like, of course, here we are, you know? Sometimes this is how God works, you know, and you just have to be awake to it. And so I said, yeah, I have a guy, a rough guy, but we have a guy, you know? So I called him back and I said, you know, got a situation, we got four kids. And the story was that this four kids had been severely abused. The mom was now had them and dad was in custody in prison. And the kids were probably never going to see him again. And that was a good thing. But it meant that Christmas was going to be really different and there wasn't much for them. And so he said, we got it covered. Give me the lists. And then the lists were beautiful, you know, socks, underwear that fit me, clothes, pencils for school. You're just like, perfect, right? This will be great for showing her what enough is, you know? So they went shopping and I decided to go with him because I didn't want this to go badly, you know? And And he shows up in his Escalade, and she gets, 13-year-old gets out of the car, and this is Paris Hilton days, okay? So Juicy Couture, little tiny dog, right? 13 years old. And like this, just totally like. And I'm like, you are cooler than me, and you're 13. Okay. Awesome. And she, they get out of the car, and they have just gone nuts shopping for these kids. And they'd wrapped them, and they put their names on them. It was just beautiful. They bought a gift card for mom to Vons. They'd done all of it, detailed. And they're just expectant and hopeful they can help somebody. We take them into the room, and I coach them, like, we're not going to open gifts in front of them. Like, this is their Christmas, so we'll just let them do that, okay? I said, okay. And the mom then of these kids said, no, like, let's open one gift in front of these nice people. And so they're opening gifts, and the youngest little boy, who had probably had the most trauma of the situation, starts to totally melt down as he opens his gift. And I'm thinking, a remote control car is nothing to cry about, you know? He said, it says it needs batteries, and I don't have batteries. And he just loses it. And I thought, I know, buddy, it's not about the batteries, is it? I know, I've been there before where I melt down over the batteries, but it's about everything else, you know? And this dad, this little boy who will probably never see his dad again, this dad runs over out of his pocket, buddy, 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 I brought batteries. And this moment I saw heaven and earth connect, right? Where this little boy and this man who lives a wealthy, prosperous life connect and gave something to each other. This beautiful moment. And so people matter most. That's what this dad wanted to teach his daughter. People matter more than getting more things. They do. But it's hard sometimes. I mean, just get me in front of a Home Goods and I want to know what's going on inside, you know? I'm like, if I'm at your Home Goods, I'm like, maybe at my Home Goods, they don't have the same stuff. So I just need to know, you know, kill the curiosity, buy a couple things, I'll be okay to go home. I'm connected to my own entitlement, my own need for more and more and more. And there is a part of me that I think sometimes thinks if I get the perfect scent of the perfect candle, life will be good, right? And sometimes it is. But I met a woman who taught me another story, and she's about 5 foot tall from India, wrapped in a sari. She came on an airplane in the 70s. And she got to JFK, and she tried her first hot dog, okay? And she got sick immediately, and she said, never again will I eat this awful American food, okay? And I told her in our conversation, we could have done better for you than a hot dog at the airport, you know? That was probably part of your problem, no. A few weeks later, she realizes she's continuing to get sick on home-cooked food, and she turns to her brother and says, I have to tell you something. And he said, what? You're really sick. Are you okay? And he said, I'm pregnant. And he said, how did that happen? And she said, do we have to go there? You know? But basically, she was unmarried, and she had this boyfriend who knew no one knew about that she'd been hooking up with for a couple years back in India. He was poor. He lived in a different part of town. He was Hindu. They were Christian. He drove a rickshaw. She was college educated. He was younger, much younger. She was 35. So this was not like the arranged marriage everybody was sort of banking on, okay? And she's in America now. Her first day's there. She's pregnant. So time goes by, and they finally tell her parents. And at 29 weeks, she goes into labor and delivers this 2-pound, 4-ounce little boy. And if he, by God's grace, he was born in America, but if he had been born in India, he probably wouldn't have come home from the hospital. And so they came home, and they didn't expect to kind of have a baby in this house with 5 brothers, right? 1 sister and 2 parents in a 2-bedroom, 2-bath apartment in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Don't you know it, you know? And they basically tried to figure out how this all fits. How does it work? You know, they said, this baby is going to be, causes so much shame, and we are going to be shamed as a family. They were afraid of the reputation of a child that didn't have the bow on it, the story, the baby shower, you know? And that was their cultural context, too, that said this is just not fitting in the story, so we kind of need to not talk about it. And so fast forward a few years, and Grandpa and Grandma had really taken ownership of raising this little boy. And they told their kids, stop it. Do not be ashamed. This little boy did nothing to you. And Grandpa decided, you know what? There's a church down the street. I'm walking this little boy to church so he can make some friends. And they went down the street and they met this church and they spent time with them. And these white Minnesota ladies, don't you know, got down and said, oh, why don't you come over for a play date? They didn't just say, oh, Sunday school's down the hall. Nice to meet you. Because this family smelled different, looked different, came from a whole different context. Instead, they invited them into their home and said, people matter most in our community. And we're going to care for this little boy, even though his story is different than ours. And it changed everything. Let me show you a cute picture of him. Come on, right? Look at that coat and the tie. Come on. Couldn't not love that little boy, you know? And he went on and he was part of their youth group and he got to be in Cub Scouts, went to camp, grew up and went to college at a Christian college and ended up graduating from Pepperdine University. And the story goes that 3 years ago, I got to walk down the aisle and marry this little boy. Yay. So this is our story. It's David's story. It's become my story too now. As we wrestle with the things that are the hardest in life, the unknowns, the people that said, we're ashamed of you. The mark that leaves on your heart and your life, right? And how God says, I'm never ashamed of you. I made you with a purpose. You're here for a reason, even though their plan wasn't for you to be here. And so we just got back from India because we wanted to learn more of this story, you know? And I'll tell you, when we were getting married, we were going through our registry and all of that, and I was 33 when I got married, so I was like, game on, you know, this is my turn. I was at Crate and Barrel with the gun. Yeah, this is good. Finally, my turn, you know. And I bought all of you a nice gift for your shower, so trust me, you know. And we're opening gifts, and David turns to me, and he's really serious. And I'm like, oh, what is going on? And he says, honey, do we need all of this stuff? Because I had a lot of people praying for me, guys, for like 30 years, you know, And so we got a lot of gifts, okay? And so we're opening them. We're like, they were just like consolation prizes. Like, thank God you're finally married. They just were glad to scratch something off their prayer list, you know? And so so we're opening them, and I realize, I go, do we need all this stuff? Yes. Yes, we do. I turn to him, I realize he was really serious, like wrestling with this. How do we have his father in India, he'd really met like one time at that point, who lives on less than $4 a day, who has very little education, no English, and lives in a very different context and story, driving a rickshaw to make a few rupees to survive. How do we hold poverty and wealth in our hands and say we're following Jesus and we're comfortable? Like, no, it was really hard. How do we get all this stuff and be cool with it? He said, Christy, this pile of gifts is about $500, and my dad makes $500 in a year. And so as we wrestled with that, that is how we began to ask the question, how do we make our life about giving more than getting? And friends, that's what I want us to think about for our kids, is like, really, entitlement sometimes about thinking you need to get. And we want the giving to be natural for them. And so what we did is we started doing research, and David works in the financial services industry, so we research everything before we purchase or do anything. If you're married to a guy like that, you understand. Or maybe you're that person. But anyways, he did a lot of research, and what we found was that an organization we already knew about was doing it really well. And that's Compassion International, the organization your church has partnered with and cares about a lot. Your pastor, Senior Pastor Mike, went down to El Salvador and fell in love with what Compassion's doing with the local church to transform the lives of kids living in poverty, to change the story in a very real way. And so that was when we first sponsored, I'll just show you our kids that we sponsored. This is Rohit, Dia, Alex, and Vivian. And Dia and Alex live in the same village David's father lives in, just outside of the town. And so it's changed a lot of things for us. We have been able to, by God's grace, change their lives, give them the food, medical care, education, clean water, love, and allow them to know the story that the one and only God loves them. But also, it's helped us put in perspective, what do we want our family culture to be, you know? Do we want the story to be told about our marriage that, wow, you guys have the sexiest cars on the block, good job, you know? I don't want that to be the story. It's fine to have a sexy car, okay? Congratulations if you do, I'm happy for you. No, I like my car too. But, you know, it's just, it's not about getting, and it's not about being guilty for what we have, okay? It's about being stewards of how we give and how we share that with the world. And so this has been our journey, is to really pour into their lives. And like I said, we went to India. We just got home. This is us kind of entering the Taj Mahal quarters. It was so fun. We got traditional clothing, of course, because shopping is fun in India because it costs very little. It's better than Home Goods. And we got the honor of really spending time with David's father, who came by rickshaw, brought us street food. It makes very little money, but spent as much as he could to really give to us, even though he has to work 12-hour days to make ends meet. Wouldn't take a dollar from us, and believe me, we tried. And so it's when we realize that, like, we're all the same in this world, like, we all have the same blood, heartbeat, soul, like we're all human, and how much money we have in our bank account doesn't change our value, you know? And that's what we believe Jesus called us to communicate to one another, is to say, you are loved and seen and valuable, and you are the shame of no one. You should be the shame of no one. God is so proud and loves you. And so it's been just an honor to kind of process this, and we just got home on Monday night, so we're definitely still a little jet lagged. It's like 10:30 at night there. So I'm doing fine because I'm a night owl. I'll be up till midnight, noon. You know, it's just been good for us to keep things in perspective. And I think the many, many MOPS moms I've met who have decided to make this part of their family culture, who make serving and giving a part of what they do, part of their ethos. I know the woman that came up and announced about your community serve day was talking about little kids and how I love that you're bringing little kids to serve day, even if they're not fully engaged in it. Even just being aware that you're going to community serve day is big. And knowing that's part of what our family does, so that when they grow old and they're raising their own families or doing their own life, this is just part of what we do. We do serve. We give to others. So the next one, let's move on, is your choices have consequences. We live in a culture that often does not highlight consequential behavior. So what I would say is if you're looking at any parent, there's so many different parenting models out there. I think one of the greatest like rubrics or way you can measure it is, do kids receive feedback of some kind for the things they're doing? They need to learn from us. No, not okay, and yes, that's great, you know? And so having a positive or negative consequence for your behavior, learning that, oh, when I touch the fire, it's hot, ouch, I don't want to do that again, is so important. One of the analogies we use in our marriage is about a story our counselor shared with us, which was, he said, if you're in line at Starbucks, and you stand in line, and someone steps back and steps on your toe. Okay? Could happen, right? And then they turn around and look at you and go, oh, my bad, sorry. Does your toe still hurt? Of course it does, right? But we do have sometimes this belief that we can just say, my bad, I didn't mean to, I'm really sorry. It's like there's still a consequence. And we have to feel that sometimes. And often, as you've probably read throughout, you know, the Facebook loveliness that is the, you know, out there, there's so many articles right now kind of critiquing this like trophy culture where we reward every behavior and reward to a point that kids don't know the value of really winning. They don't know the value of having to try harder next time. And maybe even feeling what it feels like to get an F on your test and sit with that and see it on your report card. That's important to the whole picture, is that kids know that what I do matters and impacts the people around me. And see, when we're talking about growing empathy, if you don't think that your own actions and behaviors matter, then why try, right? But if you know that what you do matters and impacts those around you, you're going to think about how you do your behavior differently. Does that make sense? Here's a quote from a friend of ours, Dr. Tim Elmore. He's an awesome resource, and he'll be on that PDF if you got that into your inbox. He has a book called Seven Damaging Parenting Behaviors That Keep Kids From Becoming Leaders. Is that a good title or what? It's like, huh. Everybody wants to know what those seven are, right? Well, he has a quote that I like. It says, kids need to fall a few times to learn it's normal. Teens likely need to break up with a boyfriend or girlfriend to appreciate the emotional maturity that lasting relationships require. If parents remove risk from children's lives, we will likely experience high arrogance and low self-esteem in our growing leaders. And isn't that true? It's usually that continuum of high arrogance and low self-esteem that seem to go together. That when we don't feel secure in who we are, connected to others in relationship, we can often go at it all for ourselves, focused only on me, 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 and just take what we need. But it's really in knowing and experiencing the hard things in life that we grow connected to others and we grow in who we are and confident in who we are and how we can move through things and do hard things and change the life of others. So the next and last one is, you are loved and so is everyone. You know, we focus sometimes a lot on saying, you are so loved. And I think it's good to remember that everyone else is too. That the God of the universe loves all of us deeply. And that our job, our command, our call in life is to make sure that we go and do the same thing that God has done for us, and to love others and to see their value, their intrinsic value as a human being, as a child of God, and communicate that to them through our eye contact and our love and our connection to them. And you, friends, will be the best model for that to your kids. To treat everyone with respect and dignity, whether they're cleaning your house or whether they're babysitting your kids or they're working at a restaurant or they're the fanciest person that you've ever met that you love. If we can treat everyone with that kind of respect, we show kids that that's the goal, that all people are valuable. We had the opportunity, I was at North Coast Calvary Chapel for the Christmas dessert this year, and I met a woman who runs the White Rainbow Project. Any of you familiar with that? Okay, I'll tell you just a little bit about it. So cool. They're doing this ministry to widows in India, and all that. That's all I heard, and I thought, awesome, good, sounds great, moved on. Then she emailed me, and I said, oh, it's so funny, we're going to India. Is there anybody you'd want us to stop by and encourage or see that, because she lives here, right? She said, oh my gosh, yes, go meet our ministry partners and then go meet these widows. And I thought, we've had kind of a heavy week hanging out with his dad. Like, maybe that's a little too much, you know? I didn't even really know what she was asking me to go do, but I knew it sounded intense. What I learned was that in India, in Hinduism, often what happens is if a woman predeceases her, or a husband predeceases his wife, the woman is seen as bad karma, bad luck on her family. And she's cast out of the family, stripped of all color, only allowed to wear a white sari, not allowed to participate in any of the festivals, and sent away. It has something to do with property, too, that the property would go to her next, and then it doesn't, and it goes to her kids. So there's a lot of messiness in this. It's really sad. And often what they do is they go to this town, Vrindavan, which is outside of Agra, where the Taj Mahal is. It's actually the birthplace of Lord Krishna. And it's a tourist destination to go and watch these women in white saris chant in the ashrams so that they can get a few rupees and buy dinner. And you imagine, these are women who have raised their families and been faithful and lived in homes and lived their lives, but they're now homeless, living in this town. There are 6,000 widows in this town. And this ministry is helping 20 of them. And so we show up, we go through this town, our cab driver gets lost, he speaks no English, we're totally like, this is a little scary, what are we going to do? We have no cell phones, but we find our way. He finds his way, connects with them. We walk in the room, let me show you, and around the perimeter of a small, tiny room sit about 20 little widows, 5 foot tall, wrapped in their little saris. And when David and I walked in the room, they jumped to their feet as though we were the president of the United States of America. I mean, literally like, sorry, I shouldn't have used that reference. Okay, sorry. Not a political statement, okay, guys? Not. I was just saying, if we were so important to them. We were like, they were so excited. Please forgive me for that if you have issue. Okay, I'm just going to leave it. We're going to forget that happened. Okay. We were so important to them. We'd come for them. These are women who don't get hugged, don't get loved, don't get held, don't get touched, don't get eye contact. And they're grieving. They've lost everything. And we walk in the room, they jump up, and they just hold on. And David and I are looking over each other's shoulders at each other. And I've got tears going down my eyes, and he's got tears streaming down his cheeks. And we're like, what in the world? I've never been greeted with so much warmth and love. Here's David hugging one of the women. And they would just hang on. And David, who had just sat with his father, who for the first time expressed, I'm so sorry that I wasn't there for you. I thought of you every day of your life. Like, what healing words on his soul, you know? To heal over that story of shame that he's believed, was there even a plan for my life? Was it, you know? And he sat in this room, and the man in charge said, would you guys just share your stories, encourage them? And we're like, we weren't prepared at all. And David said, I got this. And he looked at those women, and he told them the story that I just told you. And he said, I was the shame of my family. And I know many of you have been told you're the shame of your family. But I'm here to tell you that the God of the universe loves you, and there's nothing you can do that can separate you from his love. And you are loved, and you are not the object of his shame. And it was so beautiful to watch David use his story for the very first time to heal somebody else. And that's the gift we give when we love one another well. So we create space for God to do his miraculous work in our lives. Let me show you these gals. By the end of our time together, you would never know that they were living the hard life they were living. Big smiles, happy, still hugging, still hanging on. They made us these fresh flower lays all day waiting for us to come. Blew me away. And what I realized is that we need the least of these in the world as much as they need us. And that when we connect to them and when we connect our children to people who have great need, it fills a great need in us too, because an entitled life lacking empathy is nothing to live for. There's no contentment or joy in that kind of isolation. And so letting people know that they're loved is the goal. And inspiring our kids to transform their heart, to have experiences and encounters all along the way, that you as their parents are the greatest teacher they'll have, that they watch your life every second of the day, whether you like it or not, right? And see the love of God oozing out of your soul. You are equipped to be incredible parents already. You're already going to do it. And so this entitlement problem and all the scary things in the world that come our way aren't quite as scary when we realize that God is with us in it and that really it's through true connection that things change. So in closing, I would just love to show you a quick video that explains some of the compassion story that you're going to hear more about on Sunday too, but just a little bit, a taste of kind of where it began, of a man that decided he wanted to change one life that grew into now 1.8 million kids being helped on this globe in such effective, promising, deep ways. It's the reason we partnered with them, because we knew that there's really going to be something transformative that happens. And we've seen that over and over again. In fact, I met a man in India. He said, oh, I'm a formerly sponsored child. I grew up in this ghetto over there. And he's little kids are there. And he's got a job. And he's thriving. I thought, that's a miracle. So watch this. This is about the millionth child that was sponsored and his story. I've stood in houses just like his. And this is all just really special. So check this out. I love this because it just puts it all into perspective, you know? And here's the thing, is that no matter who we're encountering, our story has the power to change someone else's story, and their story has the power to transform ours. And one of the coolest things about sponsoring a child is that you really get to have a relationship with that child and know them and write letters back and forth. And it's really a great thing as you're trying to find practical things for kids to latch on. There's academic research that shows that if a child knows a name and a story of a child, they're able to actually empathize and connect with them. Where sometimes if we just say we're sending money to Africa to poor kids, they don't really conceptually get that because they're concrete thinkers, you know? So this is a cool way to do it. As is going to do the community serve projects you're going to be doing. So it's really cool. So as we close in prayer, I would love to just do something real quick with you. We have just such the honor as women to have this leisure time to sit and think about this kind of stuff, honestly. There's many people who are not able to really spend the time to sit and connect with each other like this. So I'd love to pray for some of these kids. I put some packets on your table that I'd love if you just pass them out, learn a name. We'll just, if nothing else, we just pray for these kids and lift them up because they all have a story unique to their name and they matter. And so I just want to pray for them. And so what I'll do is as I pray for your kids and then pray for them, if you'd learn their name, we'll pray for them out loud by their name. So if you'd just kind of join me in saying those names out loud, I'll make it really obvious how we're going to do that. So let me close this in prayer. God, thank you that you love us, that you are a God who cares about every hair on our head, who knows every story. You're not far away. You're up close and with us. God, that is good news. And we're grateful that you're a God who rewrites some of the painful stories inside of us and allows us to love one another well by sharing our stories. We just pray, God, for all the kids that are represented by these mamas in this room, that as they grow up, they would grow up confident, secure, knowing they're loved, knowing who they are and what their gifts are so that they can confidently step into the world, love others, and have deep, intimate, caring relationships. That is our prayer, Lord. We want to see transformation in this culture. We want to see empathy grow, and we want to be part of that, Lord. And God, we pray for these kids who live in extreme poverty, who have families and stories and hopes and dreams. And God, we are asking you to provide for them in each way and each need. And so we want to right now lift them up to you in prayer and honoring that you love them more than we could imagine. We're going to just say their names out loud to you. So go ahead and do that. Rohit, go ahead. Just say a name. God, we lift that up to you and just trust you to sort it out in heaven and just be with each one. We pray this in your name. Amen.
Okay, so I want to just give you a couple instructions real quick. You have this awesome opportunity with your church to sponsor a child in this village in El Salvador. There are 150 kids, and most of them are going to be out on Sunday. We brought 25 of them, especially today, for you to, if you wanted to be part of that initiative that's happening through the church, we encourage you to do that. If you feel a heart for a child in a different area, and some of these packets, there are kids in 25 countries that we work with, and you're welcome to do that. It's $38 a month. It takes care of all their basic needs, and you'll have a very close relationship with that kid as they write back and forth to you. So would love for you to think about doing that. And if you do decide to do it today, I have some posters over there that I'd love to give you as a gift, just as a thank you from me for doing that and being part of the great work of helping children in poverty. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be over there. If you do want to take that packet home today, you can. I just have to have your information written out on that little tear-off form. So that's all. So thanks. Come on over, and I'd love to meet you.